Thanks, Steve. I'm Steve B, and I'm an addict.
Hello,
And
Steve.
yeah, I
Hi,
don't want
Steve.
anyone. Yeah. I'm not sharing. Don't nobody get confused. It's not me who's sharing. It's Pete B who's sharing. I've not known Pete for very long. Only been about a year, I think. But in that short time, I saw something in Pete. That really, really sparked something off for me. He's been around. He's been around a day or two, and his experience goes right back to his experience in recovery goes right back into the early 1980s, which is when our basic text, as we know it, was born, where it was. Where it came alive, and it was written by addicts for addicts, and Pete was part of that process, and it's wonderful. I've personally find it wonderful to be able to build a relationship with someone who has that kind of experience, and it is my great pleasure today to introduce Pete B to share his experience, strength, and hope as he sees it today. Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot for that introduction, Steve. It's great to be here. I'm honored and humbled. Yeah, I got clean. I first started trying to get clean in September of 1977, but I didn't find NA until February of 1980, and I managed to get clean. My clean date is March 17th, 1980. So I had one relapse after I found you guys. This was the answer, and for any newcomers, as you're going to hear, as I tell what it was like, if I can get clean, and if I can live a fruitful life in recovery, anybody can. So let me go ahead and share a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. So I, you know, I was born in a large Irish Catholic family. I was the fifth boy, sixth kid out of seven. My mom was an addict, active until I was 9 years old, and then she found recovery. I rather thrived in the chaos of an addictive family. I had a role in it, and I thrived in that role. I was sort of like the mascot, the practical joker. I was my job was to lighten everything up because things were really heavy in that family at times, and I didn't, I can't say that didn't make me an addict. I'm an addict because I'm an addict, but I was familiar with that chaos that comes with addiction. And then when and as long as I was surrounded by my family. I sort of had a place there. I felt like I had a place, and then everything changed, and some for the better, and for me, some for the worse. When my mom cleaned up, she got what they would call sober in the other fellowship, but she it was for her it was getting clean too, because she was a very much a prescription addict. She had a medicine cabinet full of drugs that she needed on a daily basis, and she was able to immediately get into 12-step recovery over there. She, in fact, she met one of the founders of that fellowship the week before she got, before she decided that she was all in. She had a little brother that found it before her, and he was instrumental in her finding recovery through AA. What changed in my house growing up was the chaos settled down. My mom embraced the 12 steps. My dad embraced the Al-Anon program, and I heard all kinds of jargon about recovery, and it didn't mean anything to me as a kid. I was 9 years old when she got clean, but I did miss the chaos. I had a role in that, and then when the they didn't need my role anymore, and I also had older brothers and sisters started moving out of the house, and I probably went through my first depression. I didn't know that's what I was going through. And the family had just moved, across the town. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and you know, but I can remember just being isolated, and I didn't have I didn't have my family to entertain. Everybody was off doing stuff or going off to college and stuff like that. I had this idea that I was going to be an athlete. All I wanted to be when I grew up was a professional athlete, which was kind of laughable because I had no coordination at all. I was a very uncoordinated kid. I couldn't even make the Little League team, Little League baseball team. I got assigned to the minor league, and I led a walk off. I led a fight and then a walk off on my team, so I got banned from even playing. So and yet in my mind, the only thing I wanted to be when I grew up was a baseball player. So that, you know, that there was a little problem there, and I did feel just like many addicts, I felt very different. You know, I do believe I was an addict long before I picked up my first drug. First time I got high, it was love at first sight. It took all my awkwardness away. I went from being really shy around people to being, you know, I would talk about anything. It felt like it made me more intelligent, you know, because I could talk fluently, whereas I you know, without any drugs or alcohol in my system, I was, I had a hard time accessing my brain with my mouth, you know, and drugs opened that up for me. And my first 2 years in active addiction were, it was just all fun, you know. I mean, I can't tell you that I didn't enjoy getting high. I loved getting high, and I learned to be very functional as an addict. I could do lots of things. I was working hard. I worked from an early age. You know, just because it's like, if you wanted any money, you worked. You know, in a big family like ours, we weren't dirt poor, but we weren't ruling it. You didn't get an allowance. You know, if you wanted anything, you went out and worked. And there were lots of opportunities back then, you know, for a kid to go out and earn some money. When I got a job in a restaurant when I was about 15, and I've already had my first, an older brother's wedding. I'd gotten drunk and blacked out, you know, I don't remember anything about it, but I loved hearing the stories about, you know, my escapades when I was drunk, you know, and apparently I picked a fight with his best man. And, you know, I thought that was cool. You know, I thought it was cool that I wasn't this, you know, anything but who I was. I couldn't stand myself. So anything but that. And that's what drugs gave me. It gave me a whole different life. And I embraced it. And then a funny thing happened when I was, about 2 years into it, when I was 17, my family moved in the middle of my senior year of high school, and I was going to stay behind and finish up my senior year in Pittsburgh, and then join the Navy was my plan. I didn't want to have anything to do with higher education at all. I hated school. You know, I knew that if to get into the Navy, I was going to have a diploma. So I just did well enough to pass. But I threw a little party at my parents' place, but you know, we were expecting about 35 kids and about 150 showed up. You know, we had a big old house in Pittsburgh, and you know, my mom, again, you know, she's in the program, and my mom was really smart, and you know, she didn't like come down on me like a ton of bricks. What she did was she sort of challenged me. You know, she told me that, well, you know, you know, she said that her and my father thought it'd be best if I came with them to Connecticut, you know, but it's up to me. But she said, you know, we won't be able to support you if you stay here. And pretty much kind of said that I was going to be, you know, persona non grata in the family, you know, if I didn't go. And she challenged me to clean up my act, you know, and, you know, I was sort of like, at that point, I was like, sure, why not? I'll give that a try. You know, I was into that. I like things that seemed like an adventure. And I said, that sounds like an adventure. So I went for it. And I actually, the first 2 months in Connecticut, I knew I was going to have to bust my behind to be able to graduate, you know, with the class, because I had just been goofing off for 2 years. I buckled down with the school. I stayed clean for 2 months on my own. And, you know, and I just thought that, oh yeah, okay, well, all that getting high was just a part of a phase of growing up, and I'm past that now, and I don't need it anymore. And that's what I was kidding myself of, because, and you know, that might've worked out, except for I had a problem with a girl, and the only way, the only thing I knew about dealing with the problem was she got high. So I got high, you know, and I felt better about that problem. But then I wanted to get high again, and I was like, what's this? And I realized I, at that point, I just felt like I was trapped because I started getting high when I didn't want to, because I really had had a taste of, I'd had a little taste of freedom. And I didn't like how this felt that I kept needing to get high, and just weird things started happening. And I tripped for graduation night, and I tripped for the prom, which I got, you know, wound up getting talked into going with this girl. And it was just, you know, all these things were happening, and I was in a different place. And I spent my summer after high school graduation suicidal, because I just didn't know which end was up. It was no longer fun getting high. But I wanted to get high all the time, you know. So, you know, real quickly, I was introduced to the other side of addiction, and I, you know, I was just completely lost, confused. You know, I was driving down this mountain every night up in Massachusetts. With there's a nice hairpin turn that I did plan to drive off, and the night I came closest to it, after a month of doing it every night after work, I worked as a waiter at a restaurant, and I'd go after work, I'd go up and drive down this mountain. And the one time I almost did it, there it turned out there was a couple parking. It was at this scenic overlook with a 1,000-foot drop, and I almost piled right into them and took us all down. And you know, something snapped me out of it right in time, and I didn't do that. And I realized real quickly that I was a complete failure. I couldn't even kill myself, you know. Anyway, my mom, she found out that I was trying to commit suicide, and she, you know, she sent me to a shrink, and the shrink helped me a little bit, put me on something that made me feel a little better. And then, you know, and then I just, after that, I was just off to the races. I just embraced addiction. I said, well, you know, when I'm getting high, I don't want to kill myself. So I just embraced it. I did try a year of college, because I did wind up, sort of having a little intellectual awakening about education in my, you know, at the end of my senior year of all things. And I tried a year of college, and then I decided to go back to Plan A and join the Navy. And I figured the Navy would give me the discipline that I lacked. And, you know, and I guess I've earned some discipline in the Navy. And I, you know, I had a lot of plans. And I made it through a very rigorous training program. When they said I couldn't, they said I didn't have the aptitude. And I just said, well, you know, just watch me, you know. And I really buckled down, and I talked them into letting me stay there to at least try to get through. And I did really well. And, you know, and I just proved to myself that, you know, I could will anything, you know, I could use my will for anything. Because they said that I was the first one that they let stay after they flunked the physics aptitude on the entry of that. And so anyway, you know, my Navy career progressed, and as did my addiction. And I didn't see it progressing at all. I just I no longer was struggling with whether to get high or not. I just tried to get high and tried to use the best drugs I could get my hands on. And I always had somebody who was able to get them for me, because I was not good at scoring out on the street. I just couldn't. I was somebody that would easily be taken advantage of. Anytime I tried to do it on my own, I wound up not getting good stuff at all. So I had this friend on the ship, that on my second ship, that was, you know, he had great connections, and this guy always had the best drugs. And anytime I would start, you know, slow down a little bit, I'd have panic attacks, and I'd have and all this stuff. And I still wasn't tying it to drug use or anything else, but it did seem that I had more problems when I tried not getting high than when I just got high. So I kind of gave myself over to it. And like I say, I was functional. I was running a reactor on a ship, and as long as I could get high regularly, that worked. And you know, they liked my work. I had a good name, but the tragedy struck when my ship was getting ready to leave for a 7-month Mediterranean cruise. And, you know, my friend had gotten busted a few weeks before. We weren't sure whether he was going to be allowed to stay on the ship for the cruise, or whether he was going to have to go face the music. And we're pulling out of Norfolk Harbor. This was 3 days after our bicentennial. It was July 7th of 1976. And, you know, we're pulling away from the harbor, and I'm feeling like, okay, good. You know, at least I'm not gonna have to face 7 months in Mediterranean without my drugs. And they sent a boat out to get him. They called him up on the quarter deck, and they pulled him off the ship as the ship was pulling out of the harbor. And I knew right then I'm screwed. I knew it. And going across the Atlantic, it took us about 10 days to cross the Atlantic, and it was agonizing. You know, I was withdrawn most of the time. I didn't have anybody else at that point. That guy was really my only friend on the ship. You know, I'd made a lot of friends when I first got into the ship, but I just sort of, you know, fallen into this, you know, like we do. I had isolated myself, and you know, finally when we got to Morocco, our first port stop was Tangier, Morocco, and I went off and tried to score something, and it was not what it was supposed to be, and it just gave me a headache, and I was like, I'm really screwed. And I can just remember, you know, how awful that felt. You know, I didn't know how to function. I didn't know how I was going to survive this. And it wasn't like physical withdrawal so much. It was just the whole, I didn't know how to live when I was getting loaded. And fortunately, at the time, it was fortunately, this one guy had some they had some drugs that were they would sort of scratch the itch, but not really, you know. They mostly just put me to sleep, you know, but it kind of got me through the rougher parts. I had tried going off and drinking as much as I could possibly drink in these ports, but my problem with that was I would black out. And then I almost didn't make it back to the ship in Haifa, Israel, and that would have been pretty bad, and that scared the hell out of me there. So I stopped going off and drinking. I just did the drugs that my buddy had, this new friend that I'd made, and you know, and you know, that was that for that the rest of that cruise. I was just like, not, you know. I realized I needed more. I needed more than what I was getting, and it just wasn't enough. And it was awful. It was like being in prison. And you know, finally, and I did a couple of things. There's I got into a beef, not a, you know, sort of like I got a major resentment towards the captain. I did some things that I was I had good reason to be paranoid of getting caught for. And when the ship finally pulled back into the port in Norfolk, Virginia, the following year, you know, I just started, you know, I was able to get, you know, reunited with my drugs of choice, and I was having a good old time. But you know, it kind of wasn't the same. I was very paranoid. You know, the more I got high, the more paranoid I get. And I finally got just, you know, I heard that the only way I could get off the ship was if I went AWOL. So I took off. I left the ship, and I just hit the road. And I spent 2 months traveling the country under an assumed identity. You know, mostly living on the streets, living, you know, I lived in a restaurant that I got a job in for a while. I slept there. They didn't know I was sleeping there. And then finally I got picked up, I got turned in, and I got, you know, I got, a, they wound up offering me a discharge, an honorable discharge. And it was like, wow, you know, I felt like I had arrived. I had achieved, you know, freedom. Because at this point in my mind, the Navy was my problem, and I made all kinds of plans for after I got out. I was gonna relocate to the West Coast, because I spent my last 2 months in Treasure Island in San Francisco, and I had went back east to say goodbye to everybody, and I had a ride back to the West Coast. I had it all. It was all laid out for me, but I couldn't follow through on it. I knew I had to. I just had to get high. And I had to go back to Norfolk, where I knew I could get the drugs that did it for me. And real quickly, within 2 months, I was unemployable. I went from being this functional addict to I was unemployable. I couldn't, all I could do from the time I got up in the morning till the time I got bed at night was get high. And I was very aware that I was slowly losing my mind, that I was slipping mentally. And it felt like I was slipping around a bend that I was never going to come back from. And I had a moment, you know, of sanity, I guess, where I realized I just got to get out of this. I got to do something. So I decided that I hitchhiked home to my parents, and they were in the Philadelphia area, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And you know, I wound up telling my mom I got a problem. And my mom, you know, she was involved in this hotline, that referral thing. for the state of New Jersey. And you know, she tried everything that she could do to find me help. And none of it worked. I did stop using, but I quickly became suicidal, just like the last time that I tried really getting clean. And you know, my parents had said I could stay there as long as I didn't get high, and that's what I wanted too. So I stayed at their place, and I wanted to, you know, for 3 months I stayed clean, and I wanted to kill myself every single day. I could not find a reason to live clean. I just couldn't find a reason to live. That just wasn't there. I didn't know. I didn't want to go on, and I didn't want to get high. And so it's kind of between a rock and a hard place. And eventually, I realized I'm not going to wind up killing myself. I got to do something. And I learned about a program in the VA hospital, a depression clinic, and I was definitely qualified because I was very, very depressed. And I went in, and they diagnosed me manic depressive, put me on lithium, and my roommate had some kick-ass weed, and I just discovered that's a great combination. So I did that. That was my best exercise of controlled using. I did that for about 2 years. And that obviously didn't work, you know. Eventually I got on my feet, I got a job, I became employable again. I did well on the job. I didn't know anything about spiritual principles. I had started going to the meetings at the other fellowship because I wasn't drinking, and I thought that everything all the help that my mom tried to give me, everything seemed to focus on that one substance. And so I said, okay, I'll surrender that. And but I didn't hear a whole lot about steps. They had them on the wall, but I didn't hear people talking about them in the meetings. I didn't hear a whole lot about sponsorship or any of that. I just heard, don't pick up and go to meetings. And so that's what I did. And I continued, and my addiction was spiraling out of control again, and I didn't realize it until I didn't care. You know, I got to a point, my best friend died right about 5 days after he had brought me back from an out-of-body experience from doing too much of a drug at a party. He died 5 days later, and I spent 6 months just, I stopped going to those other meetings. I worked. I was a workaholic at this point, you know, so I would work and come home and get high and just try to figure out the meaning of life, you know. And I was never really that introspective before, but after my friend died, it threw me. It really threw me. We were 24, and I just never imagined life without this one friend that I had. He was the only real friend that I had. And one night I just was like, I was in my apartment. I just gotten high again, and I just remember suddenly feeling. I should mention a doctor had taken me off the lithium, and so I was feeling my feelings again. You know, the lithium. The great thing about that was it had gotten me to stop feeling like I wanted to die, but on the other hand, I couldn't feel anything. You know, I emotions were not part of the equation there. So I sort of had to live like a two-dimensional existence. I felt like the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz. And so, I this night I just had this moment. I just cried out, God, I'm alone. And then I spot you know saw the literature from that other fellowship, the thing they called the Big Book. I picked it up and I started reading it. I didn't read much back then. I didn't like reading. Reading gave me headaches when I was on that lithium, but I was off the lithium, so I was reading this thing, and I realized that there was a lot more going on in this thing they called recovery than what I was hearing about in these meetings. And I said, okay, well maybe I was going to the wrong meetings. And I went back. I stopped. I put the drugs away. I went back to the meetings, and I went looking for what I, because I felt like for a moment I didn't feel alone after I read this. I can't even tell you what part of the book I read, but something really struck me. And I went back, and I couldn't find it. But I did find something that at this AA clubhouse that saved my life, and that was another addict. And I discovered for the first time in my life, I discovered the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. And this kid had shared, and something he had said, you know, made me go up. And I usually didn't do this, but I went up after he spoke, and I asked him a few questions, and he said, well, you sound like an addict. And I was a little offended at that. I didn't know what that meant. And because I've been going to these meetings calling myself, you know, an alcoholic for 2 years, and this guy's calling me an addict. But he said it in a very friendly way, and he said, maybe you should try NA. And I asked, what's that? And he said, Narcotics Anonymous. I never heard of it. I said, no, I'm not doing narcotics. And he just laughed and he said, it's about everything. He said, you know, he said, just go to the meeting and they'll tell you. He said, there's a lot of younger people there too. So I said, okay, good. So I went to the meeting and, you know, it wasn't what I expected. The first half of the meeting, I'm sitting there and there's all these kids. Now I'm this 25 year old, I'm a disabled veteran. I've been through all kinds of stuff and, you know, and here, this is a room full of 20, 25 teenagers. You know, I don't think there was one or two that were a little over 20, but I wouldn't have guessed that. And they were all acting like teenagers. And I just was like, and that's all I saw or heard the first half of that meeting. I wasn't really listening to what they were saying. It just, they were all just freaking immature teenagers as far as I was concerned. I was just getting ready to leave when this one kid came out and introduced himself to me. I was out getting a cup of coffee and he said, I haven't seen you around here before. You know, are you new? I said, no, I've been sober for like 2.5 years, you know? And he said, oh, I see. He says, is this your first time in an NA meeting? I was like, yeah, it is. And then he proceeded and just like the next, maybe not even a minute, maybe 2 minutes. He told me what NA was, told me what addiction was, told me the difference between clean time and sobriety, difference between recovery and sobriety, and told me all about total abstinence. And I real quick, I said, oh, okay, then I'm 5 days clean. The last time I blew a joint was 5 days ago. He said, well, that's great. And you know, and then I just wound up walking back into the meeting. And, you know, I really felt a connection with this kid, just like I'd felt with that kid in that clubhouse. And I didn't know what was going on. I just felt like that loneliness was sort of like temporarily vanished. And I walked back in there and I had this thought as I was walking back into the meeting that, you know, when somebody had said that when I started using, I stopped growing emotionally. And I realized when I walked back in there, I had that thought and I said, okay, well, I started using when I was 14. So I'm just like these kids. So I decided to listen to what they had to say. In the second half of the meeting, those kids blew my shit away. I heard them sharing stuff I'd never heard anybody share from that place that they were sharing from. I was wondering, how do they do that? Because every time everyone opened their mouth, they could be a 16-year-old girl. And I'm sitting there saying, yeah, me too. And you know, and they're talking about stuff. And I'm like, wow, I'm just like these kids. And, you know, and after the meeting, I was like, I wanted to go back, you know. And they hugged, you know, and they held each other. They didn't hold hands when they did the prayer at the end. They put their arms around each other. They really made you feel welcome. And, you know, and what I realized leaving that meeting was the loneliness was gone. And I had something that I couldn't even put my finger on it till I got home and walked in the door of my apartment. I realized what else I was feeling. I was feeling hope. I hadn't dared to feel hope in years. No, not from the time that I felt trapped by addiction and gave myself over to it. I had not felt hope. And that meeting gave me hope. And I went back the next day. They had a meeting the next day and they had a step meeting. So, wow, I was like, these guys are taking this stuff seriously. I'm in the right place. Because I had always wanted to take this thing seriously, but I just didn't think it, you know, that's not what you did. But these guys were taking it seriously. They were reading the steps and really talking about them. And then, you know, everything was great. The kid who told me about it was taking me around to meetings. Like we'd drive an hour and a half, 2 hours to go to meetings way in the other side of the area. And I went to a bunch of meetings the first few weeks and I was so, you know, I was just like, that was my only, you know, that was my like, you know, high on NA kind of thing. It was great going to all these meetings, but I was still having daily obsessions to get loaded, but I decided I was going to get clean. And so I just go to a meeting and then I went back to my friends in Connecticut to tell them about, you know, what I'd found. And instead I got high and, you know, it was the only thing I knew to do there. And I came back, really, really broken up about it. And, I came back into that meeting. I told those kids, you know, I got loaded, you know, and I thought they were going to, you know, I didn't know what they were going to do, but I thought for sure somebody was going to tell me, well, you shouldn't have done what you did. You know, it's your fault. And they didn't, you know, they just said, well, yeah, you got loaded. You're an addict. You got loaded. That's what addicts do. They said, now, if you want to stay clean, why don't you try doing what we do? And I was like, oh, okay. Oh, so it's more than just going to these meetings. What do you do? And they told me, they gave me the news. The same kid that told me about, addiction and all that. He said, well, the people that stick around are the ones that get involved. And so I got involved, and I became that group secretary. And they didn't have any time requirements because apparently not too many people besides that kid had 3 years clean, and he was 20. But most of the rest of them had less than a year. Most of them were like me; they were just coming in. So if you were willing, you served. So I was willing, and I became that group secretary. And the very first group conscience meeting, they had to decide whether they were going to continue being a step meeting, and violate a tradition using the AA 12 and 12, which is what they were using, because there was no NA literature except for the little white book then. Or stop being a step meeting, and then not violate tradition. And in the wonder of group conscience, first time I ever experienced it, a third alternative came up, and it was like, let's write our own. Somebody had asked the person who the GSR had come back from a area meeting and had talked to a world board member who had told him that, that it's now considered a violation of tradition to use AA literature in the meetings. And they had been doing that for 27 years, but they decided it's time that NA, becomes its own, stops doing that. And, so the guy asked, well, what's NA literature? And he was told anything written by addicts for addicts in NA. And so we were addicts, and we had been studying the steps. So we figured, well, let's keep studying the steps. We'll do it in somebody's apartment and record it, and we'll record everybody's comments, and then we'll, I was the secretary, so I transcribed those meetings, and we did all 12 steps. We did most of the traditions that way. And I would transcribe. I'd go back home, I'd transcribe it, and then I would type it up and try to edit it into a format we could use it in our meetings. And it worked well. We were able to keep our step meeting going, and then we shared that with other groups all over Pennsylvania, so they could keep their step meetings going and not violate traditions. And it was a pretty cool thing. And that kept me clean, because in addition to having all those obsessions, my mind was just out of control. I was all over the place all the time. My mind didn't shut off. I was probably drinking 25 cups of coffee a day, and when I would type that stuff up, it was so everything would become clear. I'd be reading these words that these addicts, spoke. And it was that therapeutic value of one addict helping another just shot from my fingers in that typewriter right into my brain, and gave me a sense of calm, a tremendous sense of calm. And we went, that group, like I said, it was a bunch of kids. We did everything together. Whenever anybody went anywhere, we went in four carloads. We just went everywhere together. And somebody said something about a convention, so we didn't know what that was. So we said, yeah, sure, let's do it. And we loaded up the cars and went to this convention. And that was the first East Coast convention of Narcotics Anonymous. It was at this Bucknell University. And at that convention, I just had 90 days about a week or two before it, and I still been having fighting obsessions. And when I got to that convention, I was a piece of work. I was a mess. But we met these people there that they were just unbelievable. They had been, apparently they'd already started to do some preparation to start working on an NA. They called it the NA Big Book at the time. And they had a workshop, and they taught at the workshop. They talked about that they had a whole lot of material that people had been sending into the World Service Office all through the 70s, and they had this they had two trunks full of stuff, and they were going to start sorting it, and they're going to have this conference to start working on it, and this guy Bo was chairing this thing, and he said the one thing we don't have a whole lot of material on is stuff written specifically on the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. Now, I'm this new guy. I just celebrated 90 days. I'm sitting in the back of the room, and I'm raising my hand, and I'm saying, "We got 80 pages of that stuff. That's what we've been doing for the last 3 months." And it was just one of those moments for me. It's that moment will always be indelible in my memory, because just seeing how big his eyes got, and he just said, "Well, do you have it?" And I did have it in my room, and I went and got it. And we wound up, we became the Bristol Literature Committee, in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. That's where I got clean. And we started working on stuff. We kept doing the work that we were doing on the steps and traditions. We were encouraged to do that. But then we started getting a lot of other work to do. And I was the Bristol Literature Committee's typist. And then the Philadelphia Literature Committee, the Philadelphia Addicts wanted to get in on the deal. And, you know, Bo said, well, why don't they just come up to Bucks County? And it was like, they, you know, they lived in the city and they didn't have cars, and to get around to Bucks County, you needed a car, and it was too much. So George chaired the Bristol Literature Committee. He also started chairing the Philadelphia Literature Committee. And that was just off the rails. Those people wanted so bad to be part of this thing. You know, they met in this girl Debbie's apartment, and it was just packed full of addicts. I mean, there had to be like 30 or 35 kids crammed into this little apartment. George was out in the hallway conducting this workshop, and it was just amazing. It was beautiful. See that many people that cared that much to get this thing down. And so we had these two committees going, and that stuff kept me clean. And I should mention that my obsessions to use went away after that convention. I didn't even notice that. I was so busy. I just about a week later, I realized, you know, I haven't even thought about using once, you know. And you know, for the next 2 years that, you know, we got the we lived, ate, and breathed that work. George Goodall went off to some of the world literature conferences that worked on the book. I usually was trying to hold down a job. I went through 17 of them my first 4 years. I had a hard time in that area, but I would do a lot of typing, and then they'd send stuff. He'd bring stuff back for me to type up, and that just kept me, you know, it just kept me, you know, really, and it felt like it kept me right in the middle of things. I felt really safe from getting high. And or that I even want to get high. And the funny thing is, you know, I talked about before that I had a hard time finding a reason to live. And now it was like I was part of something, you know, that was way more than me, and it was way more than my group. And we all realized that if we could do this, if we could pull this off, and everybody said we couldn't, but we knew that if we could pull this off, that this thing was going to be around for a long time, you know, because we still weren't too sure whether NA was going to, you know, was going to last or not. I didn't know. I didn't know whether I could put my faith in NA, you know, because all I knew was a bunch of these kids until I met those addicts in Bucknell. And then I knew for sure this is it. And I got to be a part of it. You know, they said that I could participate, you know. And they had a newsletter out of Marietta called the Rainbow Connection, and you know that really fired us up, because this was addicts just writing their experience, and you know, we started writing stuff and sending it down to them, and they were publishing the stuff that we wrote, and that was so exciting, you know. And then and Bo encouraged me to start one in Philadelphia, and I did. We started the Clean Sheet. And we were able to have a newsletter for the Philadelphia area. And, you know, we would get stuff from addicts all over. Newcomers, there was no time requirement. You know, we just needed the words of addicts who were, you know, talking about how they got through the day clean. You know, we didn't have a ton of 12-step experience among us, you know, but we all knew how to stay clean for a day. And we believed that a power greater than ourselves was working through us as we put together the words. All these addicts that had written stuff for the last, you know, however many years, had written stuff and sent it in. We were charged with putting it together into a book that would help other addicts to find recovery. And, you know, that just to me was just, I still can't believe that happened. I can't believe that I was part of that, because I was, you know, I was nothing when I got here. I was absolutely nothing. And I was given this opportunity. One funny, I don't know how funny it was, but when my roommate George went off to Memphis for the Third World Literature Conference, and that was where the Gray Book was produced, actually called the Memphis Review Form, but many refer to it as Gray Book. And the Bristol Literature Committee had done the complete edits for Chapter 8, and the Philadelphia Literature Committee had done the complete edits for Chapter 10. And, George went to Memphis, and George was, very involved. He was really good at running the cut and paste, workshops at these conferences. And he got to Memphis, and it was like late in the day, and he realized he'd forgotten to pack chapters 8 and 10. And he reached out to me, and do you think you get those down here? And I tried FedEx and I tried UPS. Nobody could get it there the next day. So I don't know where the idea came from, but I went out to the Philadelphia airport and found a plane that was flying to Memphis that night, and I found a passenger who was willing to carry a package and meet a total stranger named George in Memphis, and take that, and they got there, the person. And somebody asked me recently if that was the only copy. I think it was, but we were trusting God here. It wouldn't go wrong. How could it go wrong? And that was kind of that's the way we kind of felt. And I finally did get to a World Literature Conference, the fifth World Literature Conference in Warren, Ohio. I wasn't planning to go to that. I was, I still had something with a job again. And it was right after the second East Coast Convention, which was right near us in Trenton State University. And my roommate Al came back from that. I went to it too, but I was just, like I said, I wasn't planning to go to this literature conference, but my roommate Al had heard something at that at the convention, and he was just fired up, and he knew that we had to go to Ohio. And he came back, and he asked me, and I said, no, I can't do it, and then he went downstairs. He lived downstairs, and I lived upstairs. And he came back up, and he started talking some more. And the next thing I know, we were on the road to Warren, Ohio. And and that was just actually being there for one of those World Literature. George had tried to describe what those things were like, but I'd never seen anything like it. It was just something, They were taking at that point, they were taking all the input from the fellowship, and editing into the grade book to create what would become the basic text. The next conference is where the basic text, the approval form came out of the next conference, which was in Miami. And so they sent the approval form out to the fellowship to vote on. And then they still had to do stories, and then I found out on a phone call from my friend Teresa that the seventh World Literature Conference to do the stories was going to be in our house in Ivyland, Pennsylvania. And I was like, oh my God, because I've been to Ohio. There was like 65, 70 attics in that in this big old school building, and I just couldn't imagine where, we had a 3-room little farmhouse, 2-story. We had, had. I mean, I just couldn't even imagine 30 attics in it, let alone 60. And we wound up having 65 attics over the course of that weekend. And we got all the stories together. We called attics in Japan and Australia, England, because we wanted to get attics from that were in other places. And we got the stories together, and we sent that out. And it was just quite an experience to be part of. It is part of my story. But the most important part, and I'm looking at my clock. I got about 3.5 minutes left, and I'm sorry I didn't leave more time. But I did eventually find a group where there was 12-step recovery. There were addicts who had been through all 12 steps. It was, I didn't get there until I had this surrender at about 3.5 years clean. I had this surrender on a train in New Jersey, and the next thing I know, I wind up in this meeting in South Philadelphia. And I realized that I'm home, and I realized that the 12 steps, I'd been doing, I'd had up until that point, I'd had what you what Greg Pierce once called service-based recovery. And that can work for a while, but I had reached the end of the line with that. That was I had gone as far as I could go with that, and I had just blown my life up down in Maryland. I had, I was doing everything but get high. I was not living, a spiritually based life. Desperately as I try, as I was trying, I was really trying, but I just couldn't do it. And I had this surrender, and after this surrender, I got a sponsor who took me all the way through 12 steps, and everything changed with that. That was the summer of 1984, and that stands out in my mind as just this unbelievable summer. This is my summer of freedom. because, you know, up until then, I think things still could have gone either way with me. But, you know, my sponsor, when we got to the third step, you know, he told me, you know, be careful here. He said, because if you completely give yourself to this simple program, even you won't be able to screw it up. And he knew who he was talking to, because I had screwed a lot of things up clean. I'd gone to jail 3 years clean. You know, I'd had to work prison camps. You know, I had not lived a life on spiritual principle. You know, I had been involved with something that was very spiritual, but I was not living it in my life. And, you know, what he told me then has proven to be true ever since. I have not been able to screw this up. I am dedicated to living, you know, I work with a sponsor still. I meet with my sponsor twice a week. We do step work. I work with, right now, I'm actively sponsoring about 10 addicts all over the world. And we do weekly, we get together to do step work. You know, to me, this is what and 10 and 11 and 12, I work on a daily basis. You know, that first sponsor that I had at that group really instilled in me how important it is to practice these principles every single day. You know, don't get a day off from practicing, you know, from working the steps, you know, because I'd gone through those first nine, I had the tools that I needed to be able to practice them on a regular basis in my 10th step and the 11th step. And I can't even imagine trying to live my life without these steps. You know, I know where it would go real quick. I would go back to getting high until I couldn't stand it anymore. And then I would just want to kill myself. And I probably would figure out how to do it. But today, I want to live. I want to live another 34 years if I can. I'm 66, and if I could get to be 100, you know, I'm sort of trying to make some deals with God here, you know. I know it don't work that way. But if I go out tomorrow and I drop dead, my life has been very full. I've had a very full and abundant life in recovery. And again, for the newcomer, I just want to say, this program works. However you got here, you know, this can be the beginning of an amazing journey, because everybody I know has had an amazing journey in recovery. It's just an amazing life. We have so much to live for, and this program gives us the tools to be able to live it to the fullest. And with that, I will shut up and listen to what y'all have to say. Thanks.